Funding for WPLN News comes from you, our listeners, and Bernstein Private Wealth, working with creators and innovators to invest with intention and build the legacy they want to leave behind. More at Bernstein.com.
I'm Jay Voorhees, filling in for Khalil Ekalana, and this is Nashville. For the past 10 years, I've been the pastor of the City Red Chapel United Methodist Church in Madison. Our church, in partnership with Community Care Fellowship, houses two transitional living shelters and provides showers, laundry, and other services to people living on the streets. For more years than I would like to admit, Nashville has been trying to address the needs of those experiencing homelessness. And yet, despite lots of work and effort, we continue to struggle to find answers that move folks from the streets into stable housing where they can thrive. Today, we will be talking with some experts on the issue and how we as a city might better address the needs of those who have no place to lay their heads. Joining us today are Adam Riggi and Sally Lott with Community Solutions, an organization dedicated to ending homelessness through their Built for Zero initiative, a movement of more than 100 cities and counties using data to radically change how they work and the impact they can achieve, and proving that it's possible to make homelessness rare and brief. Adam is the Director of Strategy and Evaluation for Built for Zero, and Sally, a former Nashvillian, is the System Improvement Advisor. Adam and Sally, welcome to This is Nashville.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jay.
Adam, can you give us a quick overview of what the Built for Zero movement is and how it works to end homelessness?
Yeah, I would love to, Jay, and thank you so much for inviting us to the call today. So Built for Zero is a movement that has been around since 2016, led by Community Solutions. Community Solutions had just wrapped up a major initiative called 100,000 Homes and moved into a new initiative or a new movement called Built for Zero. You know, for the last 8 years, we've been working with over 100 communities across the United States, from some of the smallest communities in Appalachian Virginia to some of our largest cities in the country, including Nashville. And there, you know, we work with communities in supporting them in adopting what we call the Built for Zero model, which is really a data-driven, evidence-driven approach to solving homelessness. So the core elements of Built for Zero with the over 100 communities we work with are focused on, you know, working with communities to develop a shared goal, right? So like a goal of ending homelessness, and having that a measurable goal as well. So it's not just some abstraction, but it's actually a goal that can be measured. Working on developing what we call a community-wide team that is accountable and working together to solve the problem, right? So we have a shared goal and then collaboration. And this isn't just at a program level, but at a community level. It may involve, you know, it will involve programs, but also involve community members as well to get together to try to solve, you know, solve the problem by trying to see reductions in homelessness. The third one is what we call a biname data. And this idea that you can't solve a problem you can't measure. And what biname data is a way for a community to know how many people are experiencing homelessness, the reasons why they're coming into homelessness, and the reasons why they're leaving. And this is measured on at least a monthly basis, right? So that communities can be able to adjust and change and learn from what they're doing to see what's working. Fourth, really focusing on equity, ensuring equity, you know, equitable outcomes, whether it be race, gender, you know, sexual orientation, what have you. And that is essential as part of this whole system to ensure that there are not unintended consequences happening. And then lastly, you know, with this data-driven approach and really community collaboration approach, you know, we're funding and investing in what works, right? So having, you know, data on the problem, well, you know, continue. We've seen this in many communities. Allows them to invest in solutions that get people off the streets and into safe, affordable housing. So, with that, you know, this is really the core components of the Built for Zero model. And we, you know, we work, like I said, with communities all across the United States and supporting adoption of the model.
Gotcha. Sally, you know, you worked for the Office of Homeless Services for a bunch of years as their coordinated entry director, and I'm wondering, what do you think the Built for Zero program offers Nashville that maybe we haven't had in the past?
Sure. And I think, well, one, I'll say I feel very lucky to continue to work with Nashville in my role at Built for Zero, because as you mentioned, I worked in homelessness services there for many years. And so it's very dear to my heart. I think that Nashville has an amazing system. They really have set a foundation for having an effective and resilient homelessness response system. And Built for Zero recognizes that people on the ground and people in their community know their system best, they know their city best, and they are the experts. And so Built for Zero is really there and in Nashville to continue to empower local leaders, empower people with lived experience, and create space for creativity, problem solving, peer learning, and quality improvement and improving the system that's in place.
I'm wondering, you know, sometimes we seem to differ about how we define certain things. You know, what is success? What is failure? What are the things we're doing? What is it that Built for Zero kind of brings to the table in terms of having a common language or a common grammar for how we talk about what we're facing here in Nashville?
Mm-hmm. It's important with Built for Zero, and, you know, Adam chime in as well, that there is a shared goal in a community around ending homelessness. And I think that, you know, service providers in the Nashville community are committed to that goal, and being able to form the work and build the work around that goal and have everyone aligned is really important to drive reductions and move work forward.
So the work that you've done so far is focused on homeless veterans and families. Tell us how that went. How did things go here in terms of those communities, and what challenges do you think Nashville faces in the future?
So Built for Zero has been supporting the veterans work closely since 2019 and the family work since 2020. And there have been great successes along the way. There have been reductions in the veteran homelessness population of the veteran by name list, which is that list of actively homeless veterans that Adam referenced. And most recently, there's been a really powerful 100-day family challenge campaign that was led by local partners in Nashville, but supported by Built for Zero. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of successes there. There's been a lot of successes in Nashville around leadership and building leadership and staff capacity. There's been great improvements around the data infrastructure. I know the community there has worked tirelessly to improve data infrastructure and have quality data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so for me, kind of what's next is to continue to build on those things, like to build cross-sector partnerships and alignment, to increase resource mobilization, and to kind of have an improvement and shift in kind of the narrative around homelessness, and that it is an ending, it is possible.
Gotcha. Gotcha. I know I can speak from experience. You know, we have a family shelter at our church, and mm-hmm. we had folks that were part of that 100-day campaign, and it was really successful to move folks forward, although it seems like it's kind of dropped off a little bit. But I'm hopeful that we can keep moving forward with the work that you've already done. If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville. I'm your host, Jay Voorhees, and we're talking this hour about strategies for addressing homelessness in Nashville. Adam Riggi and Sally Lott with Community Solutions Built for Zero campaign are here with us. Hey, Adam, the Supreme Court considered today the Grants Pass versus Johnson case, which focuses on legal issues related to homelessness. We have a voice memo from local advocates with Open Table Nashville who are on site in D.C. Let's take a listen.
And we won't be silent anymore. Here's the last one. Oh, if we've been just a little too quiet, you know it's gone.
I say housing, you say
yeah.
Yeah. I say housing, you say
now. Yeah. I say housing, you say now.
Yeah.
Housing,
now. Yeah.
So, Adam, I know that Community Solutions was a partner in an amicus brief for this case. Can you sum up the case and what impact it will have on all of our work?
Yeah. So, you know, the Supreme Court heard the case of Johnson versus Grants Pass, which Grants Pass is a city in Oregon that had passed a law that made sleeping outside, sleeping in tents or out, you know, outside, a criminal offense. And so this has actually been in the, you know, in appeals courts and finally got to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court heard opening arguments recently. So the current state and what the challenge here is that the what the question is, can a municipality, can a city, charge people for sleeping outside, even if they don't have housing available for those people or even shelter beds? And that's what's happening in Grants Pass and in many other cities across the country, where that they don't have, cities don't have the number of shelter beds or the housing affordable to, affordable housing for folks to move into. And so the Supreme Court's going to be, you know, we anticipate in the next few months to be ruling on this, whether or not Grants Pass has the authority to do that, whether or not it falls under the Eighth Amendment, or if they don't. And it's going to have some pretty wide-ranging implications in that, you know, up to this point, communities haven't really been able to, or cities or counties haven't been able to criminally charge people for sleeping outside in public spaces if they don't have shelter or affordable housing where they can move into. This would open that up. One thing we know is that the reality of this is that the evidence is very clear that arresting people for sleeping outside just perpetuates homelessness. Right. It increases the likelihood that they will have unpaid fines, which leads to further incarceration, less likely to get employment, and so forth. So we know that housing is a solution, and arresting people for sleeping on the street is not a solution. It would just continue to perpetuate the homelessness challenge in many communities.
Yeah, well, certainly in Tennessee, we're definitely aware of the attempt to criminalize homelessness, and we are hopeful that the Supreme Court will hear this case and make it impossible to criminalize folks that just don't have anywhere to live. So, well, I want to thank you all for being here with us today, for the work you're doing in trying to end homelessness throughout the nation. And so coming up, we'll continue the conversation with three of Nashville's leaders in addressing the needs of those experiencing homelessness in our city and how we might better answer the questions of those who don't know where to turn. I'm Jay Voorhees, and this is Nashville. I'm Jay Voorhees, and this is Nashville. Before the break, we heard from Adam Riggi and Sally Lott on how Community Solutions Built for Zero movement is working with a data-driven, person-centered approach to help cities move toward ending homelessness. Now we're going to talk about what it truly means to assist people to move from homelessness to housing. This is Nashville's managing editor, Tasha A.F. Lemley, went out to catch up with some folks who have been through this process. Let's take a listen.
Hey. Candy Huddleston and her three kids aren't getting into a routine. It's breakfast, school, work, and then home for the night.
Normal's weird. Normal's my weird. The first day I was standing on the porch and I was like, bye, and then bye, and then bye. And I was just like, man, what do I do? I feel like right now I am out of the storm, and this is definitely what I've said for myself. I'm out of the storm. You feel your boat is rocking. And now it's like, which direction am I going?
During her family's year of homelessness, they juggled living out of a car during the day and the mission at night. She says it was exhausting being a human hermit crab.
I don't think that you understand the mindset of fight or flight that I have been in, to where I'm like, get up at 4:30 because everybody needs to get up and get dressed. While there's three other families trying to get up and get dressed with you, and for one little bathroom that y'all have, you're going back out and it's freezing cold. It's pitch black. There's no sun out. There's no breakfast spots open to get these kids any food. There's food being served downstairs in the mission, but you got to go now. You cannot. Or they're going to all miss their buses. They're going to be late for school. And it happens so fast from 4:30 to 6:30 where your mind's like, ah, and then you got to go to work. And you're like, ah, and then you get to work and you're like, ah, and then they're about to be out of school and you're like, ah, and then you're about to go home and you're like, oh my God, we're going to miss dinner because we're not going to make it to the mission. Like, I'm just thinking day to day. Literally 1 hour to 1 hour. I'm just get this few hours down so where you can actually make it through Monday And then you still got to get to Friday and you don't even get paid this week. Oh, Bear, Bear, Pawpaw's outside.
Yay. After the mission, Candy and her kids moved into Safe Haven's temporary shelter. There, she says she started relaxing. They had their own bathroom and reserved beds. And then it wasn't long until the program had secured her a house and they were moving in. She was still scared of messing it all up.
Get you a jacket so you're not cold, okay? Okay. It's probably gonna rain this weekend. Certain situations had made us feel like we were just not meant to be somewhere, you know? So I was tiptoed, walked on eggshells. I was living in Springfield and I had got an eviction notice because my daughter had put chalk on the sidewalk. Like, in a visible area where it would rain. And I was like, there's no way that we got like a 30-day notice for chalk. And I went outside and I poured a pot of water. It was gone. I walked right back in the house. But I let them chalk it up. Chalk it up. Do chalk on the front porch. Do it on the sidewalk because we have that. You know, like, these are things that I wanted my kids to have. You know, a little area to just kind of do your own thing.
Candy has a case manager that checks in with her every other week. They make sure she has the therapy, food, and toiletries she needs. They help coordinate the kids' summer schedules, and they communicate with the landlord on her behalf. It's a support she says she's grateful for. If she needs them, they're there. And if she doesn't, they keep their distance. This kind of support will last a year.
My needs are met. Now I'm able to enjoy life and enjoy myself and enjoy my time and enjoy my kids and enjoy my job. And I'm just enjoying things. I got a frother. What the hell? What? I'm frothing my milk for my coffee. What? I'm sitting in my rocking chair reading a book. What the heck is going on? I did a puzzle the other day. And it was okay to do. I've been taking my vitamins. I've been going for walks. I've been exercising. I've been eating right. My mind is good to where I'm thinking about, like, what can I do for somebody else now?
I want to welcome three local guests, Rachel Hester, Executive Director of Room in the Inn, Tracy Pekovich, Program Manager at the Mental Health Cooperative, and April Calvin, Director of the Metro Office of Homeless Services, who've been part of the housing process from the inside. Rachel, most folks know Room in the Inn for its winter shelter program, but you offer a full range of services from shelter to respite care to permanent housing. In your view, what's the most important thing in helping people move from homelessness towards stable housing?
I think it's the willingness to see that they are worthy. Not to only see that they're worthy, but let them know that they are worthy of having something that's beautiful, having something that's theirs, and that we aren't going to leave them, which moves us into community.
How do you think you do that through the work you're doing? I mean, what's the most important thing in terms of connecting with folks and helping them to begin to feel worthy?
I think it's listening to their truth, listening to their stories, their fears, understanding where, you know, what their hopes are. Nobody wants to live in affordable housing forever, but this is just a stepping stone, right? And so for us to bring people in and provide a nice place, a place that's safe, that's important. Affordable housing is not always in a safe place.
Right.
And then to wrap around it, support services that are nurturing and healing and full of love. And then ultimately, what happens out of that is the beauty of community. Yeah. Community's messy. That doesn't come because you put it on a wall.
Right.
It comes because you put in the work.
Gotcha. Tracy, I know Mental Health Co-op is a long-standing street outreach team. And what do you think it takes to truly engage people and assist them off the streets, especially if they've been experiencing homelessness for an extremely long time?
Well, first of all, it takes time. You know, it takes consistency in being present. It takes effort in finding people when they're, you know, wherever they are. But it takes time, and it takes to Rachel's point, it takes understanding and a willingness to hear somebody's story, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and to get their input and to hear their goals. And it takes time to build that relationship, and it frankly takes time to take all the stepping stones that it takes along the way to get somebody from the streets into housing.
Yeah, it seems, though, that sometimes folks are really impatient and not quite willing to take that time, that there's this desire to want to sort of end homelessness immediately. I mean, how do we begin to help folks understand that this is a relationship we're building and it takes some time to make that happen?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, any of us would struggle to trust somebody straight out of the gate, straight out of our first conversation with somebody, right? I would be not likely to share my personal information with somebody the first time I met them. But in order to get somebody some of the resources that they need, we're asking them very personal questions. Their sure. social security number, their date of birth, you know, some really private information. And so you have to have trust, and you have to be trustworthy, and in order to have that, it does take time. And so I don't think people understand how difficult it can be for somebody who maybe the people that are closest to them have brushed them aside, or they're estranged with, and maybe they have broken relationships. And so all of a sudden somebody presents to them that wants to truly help them. It's going to take time for them to build relationships with those folks to be able to get the information that's needed to get them plugged into the resources that can get them into housing. Yeah.
This is really a question for all of you, but we talk a lot about affordable housing in this city and the need for more affordable housing. But what does that really mean when we're talking about trying to help folks that are experiencing homelessness? What does affordable housing look like?
For the cost, or for what are the components that make it up?
Let's forget about the cost. Let's
okay.
dream.
Okay.
And so if you were the Pope of Nashville and were able to say, this is what affordable housing would look like for the people you serve, mm-hmm. what would that look like?
I think it would, I think it would be set up in a way that is conducive to community, mm-hmm. conducive to access to transportation and to food, not right outside the door of the drug dealer, the loan shark, and the bootlegger.
Right.
A place that they can bring their family to and be proud.
Okay.
To reconnect. I think it is a place that they would be proud to call home.
Mm-hmm. Obviously. Tracy, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's got to be a place that the people are proud of and where they feel safe.
Gotcha.
And, you know, people that have experienced lack of housing and or been unhoused, and there's just, unfortunately, they've been in environments that are just unsafe, and their community at times is unsafe. And so we, in order to give somebody an opportunity to be proud, I mean, stability comes from safety. And I think being proud of it, but also just feeling like you can finally lay your head down at night and get a good night's rest because you feel safe.
That's one of the things that I've kind of wondered about. And April, I'm going to come to you in just a second, I mm-hmm. promise. But that it seems like we focus so much on housing that we kind of miss that stability piece. Mm-hmm. That how are we want people not just to be under roof, but we want them to also be able to thrive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And April, what in terms of the city and the resources your department has, what are some of the things that you're able to offer when folks come to my door and they're saying, hey, I need help, I don't know what to do, what would you tell them?
Well, I'll start with answering one of the previous questions, if you don't
sure.
mind.
Sure. No, it's fine.
Okay, great. Just want to follow up with choice.
Yeah.
Choice is huge, you know, when you ask what should be included in someone moving into permanent housing. I think choice, I think keeping a community together, because they oftentimes lean on each other when mm-hmm. whether they're sheltered or living unsheltered. And then ensuring that those wraparound resources are deployed to wherever they are, because that is the stability question.
Sure.
That is what will help them to thrive, providing the on-site, in the homes, supportive service options that are needed in order to help them move forward with their life. Mm. I think the other huge thing is helping them to acclimate to their new community.
Right.
So ensuring that when they have those supportive services, are they connecting them to the local grocery store? Are they connecting to them to the local NA meeting? Do mm-hmm. they know where, if there's a church option in that neighborhood?
Right.
Where do they go for you know, Second Harvest food pantry if they need one, just helping them to reacclimate into society.
Sure. So I know that we talk a lot about choice, but it does seem like right now our choices are pretty limited in Nashville, that we don't have a lot of options for folks. And I know some of that's out of our hands. Some of that the state legislature has kind of put on us in terms of some laws. But how are we doing for choice in Nashville?
One of our best resources would be the voucher system. Mm-hmm. MDHA is a great partner, and they offer vouchers per month to mm-hmm. our department to help deploy across the community. And mm-hmm. then that offers choice. We have a landlord engagement department that has really stepped up their game in securing locations for permanent housing across Davidson County. And that's anything from apartments to private landlords to large developments. So we have a lot of options coming on. Right now, actually, we just had to have a really strong conversation with the service provider to say, you can't put your client on 7 of the interest lists that are available sure. because it's kind of clogging up the system. So yeah. this is a great time right now in Nashville with choice.
So in terms of clogging up the system, you know, I know that there's been an emphasis on closing down some encampments through the past year or so. And, you know, I mean, according to the last data I saw, you know, we have about 3,500 people in the HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System. So isn't there sometimes when we focus on these encampments, doesn't that sort of knock some other people out of the loop in terms of trying to get them off the streets, maybe folks that have been waiting for a long time?
Great question. I'll say that the encampment work is really a subset of the work that's actually going on in our community. We house almost 2,000 people this year. Only 189 of them were people that were actually living in an encampment. So when we focused on encampments as a community, mm-hmm. the unfortunate piece is it took over like 75% of the verbal conversation,
sure.
which left families or youth or the veteran population feeling as though they were not a part of the system. But to house almost 2,000 people in 1 year's time and only 100, that's 10%.
Right.
Only 10% was that focus was on.
Gotcha. You know, it's and you and I have talked about before, the hard part for me is that I live in a community or work in a community that has a lot of homeless people, but it tends to be dispersed. Mm-hmm. And it's not a large encampment. So it feels like there's no attention given to our community. I know there is some. But I just wonder, how do we help communities where there maybe aren't a big encampment feel like there's actually being work done in their community?
So our outreach team, we have 7 outreach members, and we've divided them into quadrants. And we're mm-hmm. looking to host resource fairs and service fairs. I think that Mental Health Co-op has been a part of almost every one of them that we've had, where we actually take those resource fairs and service fairs to the location. Also ensuring that coordinated entry is the focus. So we have kind of a 3-part thing going on. One is weekly service fairs in those locations. 2 is monthly resource fairs mm-hmm. in the different quadrants. And then the 3rd would be looking at camp cleanup. How can we offer dignity for people that are living outside, unfortunately?
Sure.
Connecting them to services and resources.
Yeah, go ahead,
Rachel. I also think, though, we have to lean into some of the systems that are already in place, right? So the police, for example, the mm-hmm. police... The police department has regular, the police academy. They now do an immersion experience where they get to know different communities. Every couple months, they come to Room in the Inn for 3 hours. I enlist some of our individuals who are living in our supportive housing mm-hmm. to be part of that training, to tell them their stories, to answer questions. Because I think for the officers, the more they understand our community, the better they are going to be at dispersing that information as well.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
I think early on they asked me what was one of the myths, if I had 3 to name, and I think one is saying that MNPD should not be a part of
a housing crisis resolution system. Mm-hmm. As you can see, we can't do this work without them. A lot of times they know the client's names before some of the social service providers. They also know when they look sick today or when they need help or, you know, this one is out of medicine. Mm-hmm. They help with directing that. I think MNPD here locally has done great with having community engagement officers and quality of life teams that are deployed out into the encampments as well.
Sure. And I know Mental Health Co-op is partnering with the police and the Partners in Care program, because obviously involving police can bring trauma to people along the way. I'm wondering, Tracy, about your workers that are engaged in this work and and for all of you. This is hard work for the folks that are doing it. How do we avoid burnout? Because I see in certain agencies where it seems like turnover is huge, and that goes against our trying to build relationships thing.
It's so true, so there is a certain level of just compassion fatigue that comes when you're hearing, you know, it's not just a story, right? We talk about hearing a person's story, but what we're really hearing, we're hearing their life. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that helps, I think, our outreach workers, not just at the Mental Health Cooperative, but throughout the city, is there's really a solid team effort amongst a lot of the community providers through outreach coordination meetings and events that they've done together, even the resource fairs that April's talking about. There's an alignment and friendships within those outreach workers and outreach coordinators. Mm-hmm. But so it is, you know, the shared vision as well as the shared work and sharing the successes is super important. And absolutely, I do think it is the successes that really keep people going.
Okay. April, I do want to turn to you. So Cleo walks up to the door of my church and says, I need a place. I'm on the streets. I've been on the streets for 5 or 10 years. I need some help. Well, can you walk us through the process of engagement and how we move forward? What do I respond to Cleo with? Mm-hmm.
So everyone's different, just depending on what their needs are. Mm-hmm. If there's someone that wants to go to recovery, we have several recovery options that they can go to pretty quickly. If they're in a mental health crisis, we would partner with our, you know, Partners in Care, depending on that situation. If it's actually moving into permanent housing, we would connect with them on getting in, I don't want to use like acronyms, so stop me when I do, mm-hmm. but our coordinated entry system, we call that CE, making sure that they're enrolled in coordinated entry. We follow national best practices of ensuring that we're trying to serve those that are the most vulnerable, those that are experiencing chronic level homelessness, so that for one, we're following what HUD's guidances are because they're our largest funder in this space. So sometimes it does not always feel like the right thing to do because you may be turning away someone that may not be deemed as the most vulnerable and they showed up at your door. So you're looking for options and resources. And for me, when you're looking for options and resources, it may not always mean that they get put to the front of the list. Mm-hmm. I know everyone's wanting to, you know, they discuss that list.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure that.
Just help us understand coordinated entry and what that is. I think that would be helpful.
Sally Lott, who was just on, she's like the coordinated entry guru. But coordinated entry, it's a assessment process where you assess based on vulnerability. And I think the government's idea is you deploy the most funds to those that are experiencing vulnerable or chronic level homelessness, those that are more vulnerable. And then thinking of those that may not need that level of support could oftentimes utilize a softer touch or maybe just need a deposit. So you would not deploy all of the services that you would deploy for coordinated entry. Yeah. So that process is a phone assessment or an in-person assessment if you're connected to an outreach worker. And there's no, you know, chronological order. There's not, you know, it's a dynamic list. Sure. It moves weekly.
Sure. Rachel, how does that work for your agency in terms of when folks show up and are looking for help? What does that look like?
We are blessed to partner with Office of Homeless Services. They come every Wednesday and we give two workers some space to do that. To do that assessment. And then what I was also going to just say is we can't depend on the government for everything.
Right.
I think that's, if anybody takes anything away, we need a community that is diverse. We need a portfolio that's diverse because there's always going to be people who still fall out of every system that we create. And so as people are listening today, I think if someone has an idea of any kind, we should be willing to listen.
So if y'all were to ask, I mean, in terms of the greatest, again, we're dreaming big here. So if y'all were to say what the greatest need is, right? I know housing. We're all going to say housing. So beyond housing, what is the greatest need we have in terms of trying to help those who are on the streets?
I'd say capacity.
Okay.
Nashville, in a post-pandemic era with turnover, burnout, I think Nashville has limited capacity to serve. I think everyone's doing the best that they can as far as connecting to people that have lived outside an average of 5 years. And I think that's where. Also, one thing that, you know, when we think about resources that are available, philanthropic community and faith-based community, there's some untapped into resources that I think we should connect with.
Okay. I know, you know, one of the things, we had a Housing First conference recently that Sam Samaras came and spoke at. And one of the things he talked about was this ratio of kind of staff to client of like 10 to 1. Is there ever any way we can reach that kind of degree of engagement here in our city?
I don't know if I would hope that there would be the ability to do that. And I think that goes back to my earlier comment about how it just takes time. And the thing is, if you have a ratio like that, then it allows the outreach specialist or the support to really consistently engage and connect with the individuals that they're serving. I think we're certainly improving in that for sure over the past several years. But it takes time. It takes understanding. And to Rachel's point, we can't always depend on the federal dollars to do that because time's going on, right? And you got to wait for funding like that, and we got to get creative about how we find that.
Right. Room in the Inn has 48 affordable housing units.
Right.
The people that I serve have fallen out of the traditional systems. Most of them have such complicated backgrounds they wouldn't qualify for a lot of housing, or even if they were on that by names list. Some of them are so complicated. Mm-hmm. Arson, for example. But when you listen to someone's story, the rest of the story, what you find out is actually that gentleman was a hoarder, and he had a cat, and he had a candle. And when I talked to the landlord, they said if we hadn't charged him with arson, we wouldn't have had our insurance money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then what our support services need to be is to make sure he doesn't hoard.
Right.
He doesn't have an animal in his home. We don't have open flames. Those are the support services we can wrap around. And when we did that, the man lived with us until his last days and died in his own bed.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is the willingness to listen to the stories are important. The willingness to not put people in buckets that they're unlovable, unhousable, that is just not true.
What else do landlords need, do you think, to get more landlords on board to be able to do affordable housing?
I think education. We spend a lot of time educating landlords, developers, property managers of our system, and they also would like to know that someone's going to be there when they're in need. Mm-hmm. So if you house someone and there's a crisis or a problem, they want to know that that agency or our department will step in if there was a need. So I think that we have been super great at bringing on landlords because we do have a little bit of a sign-on bonus and we have some funds for minor repair. And I think that's been helpful in bringing on more landlords.
Trey, go ahead.
I was just going to kind of add on to that. I think not just education, but education in a trauma-informed approach. I mean, that's kind of a buzzword, right, that we use in a lot of different places. But the reality is the people that we're serving and trying to help get into housing do come with a variety of traumas, and trauma manifests itself in very different ways in different places. And so if we can educate landlords to know that if somebody's yelling at their neighbor, it doesn't mean they're a bad person. It doesn't mean that they should be kicked out because they can't get along with others. But being able to provide the supports, provide the education to help people understand where certain behaviors come from and get treatment or resources, I think that's necessary for sure.
There is so much we could talk about, and we could unpack this for a long, long time. But I want to thank you, our guests, Rachel Hester, Tracy Bukovich, and April Calvin, for taking time out of their day to talk with us. And I want to thank you for all that you do for our city. We have to take one last break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by someone who has experienced homelessness firsthand, Vicki Batcher. Join the conversation by tweeting us at This Is Nashville. We'll be right back. I'm Jay Voorhees, and this is Nashville. I'm joined by Vicki Batcher. Vicki has been a guest on this show in the past and is a person who has experienced homelessness firsthand. She's now housed in an apartment and is a board member of Neighborhood Health, a local nonprofit that provides health care to low-income residents and runs the downtown homeless clinic and mobile health clinic, providing medical needs in encampments. Vicki, thanks for being on This Is Nashville. I understand that we've met in the past. What'd you get? Tell me more.
I actually remember where I remember you from. I had been invited to an event from a local nonprofit, and I had gotten there a little early, like I always did, and they kicked me off the property.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Apparently, I was in a place on the property that I shouldn't have been in. I saw some other people out there, so I thought I would just go there and sit. And
right.
They actually said they were going to call the police if I didn't get off the property.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that that happened. And, you know, it's one of those things, it's the ongoing struggle that we face, which is we want to help people, and yet we also have neighbors and others that then start complaining, and it gets a little bit weird. So we apologize. I apologize on behalf of all of us. So you've heard our conversation today. What has jumped out at you?
What has really jumped out at me is this word that they keep using, wraparound services.
Right.
What I've seen firsthand from living in government housing is when they get dropped off into housing, they're given a sheet of paper, call here for food, call blah, 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 on down.
Sure.
It's part of building that trust and maintaining that trust once they get in housing. Come by. See if they need anything. Maybe they were too shy to call or embarrassed to have to call. Keep in touch. They're not. They're just dropping them off and letting them have at it.
Right. So support, what we're really talking about is what we sometimes also call support services. Mm-hmm. So I mean, how does that really look? I mean, you've given a couple of examples, but for you personally, what is it that you've needed as you've moved into your apartment or as you've moved from the streets into housing?
Mental health services would have been great, just to clear out the cobwebs in my head.
Right.
Because it took an adjustment period, not waking up every 5 minutes because I heard something funny.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. But having somebody who would come by or even call me or Zoom call me once a week to find out how I'm doing, maybe reset my goals. This kind of interaction where you're just dropped off and you've got to stumble along. And a lot of times in government housing, that's going back to what you had gotten into homelessness in the first place.
You know, one of the things that we talk about sometimes in our program is the idea of not just recovery from addiction, which we often, you know, a lot of folks come in with addiction issues, but recovery from the experience of homelessness. What does that recovery look like to you?
That recovery looked like it did on January 29th when I moved into a regular, normal apartment and sharing it with two other people, my kids. That's what the ultimate goal is. But when you're first off the streets into an apartment, everything is not rose. When you take the rose-colored glasses off after 6 months, that's when things start becoming real. I can go outside. I can go down to catch the bus, and I can leave my ES dog, and she'll be safe. That's what that recovery process looks like. Right. I'm still going through recovery issues.
How do you think the conversation that we've had today is disconnected from the actual experience of being homeless?
No human contact. Everybody's relying on data. I heard someone mention that there were 7
group, 7 people for all the quadrants. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding. 1 social worker, 7 social workers for Davidson County? Mm-hmm. You got to be kidding. We need more than that. We need twice a week coming out. Maybe you know where we hang out during the day. Come by, sit down, have a conversation. Yeah. Get to build that trust. But too many times it's filling out your form, giving it to them, and not hearing from them for 6 months.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is that what we really need is people that are investing in people, in relationships, in the kind of connection that allows you to develop trust over time.
Yes.
But that really seems to be a struggle sometimes. Why do you think we struggle so much with that?
Because we burn these social workers out so quickly. You know, you go into something having an ideal, an idea of helping people, and all of a sudden you just feel like a paper pusher.
Right.
That I've heard from a couple of them, and they said they've gotten away from meeting with the people, creating those relationships, mm-hmm. and it's just, there's absolutely no trust.
Do you think that, you know, sometimes they'll talk about peer recovery specialists or peer kinds of groups. What might that look like, and how would that be a helpful resource for folks?
I have always imagined a homeless group, mm-hmm. Where people who have been homeless or are still homeless get together and talk about their problems, talk about the issues, get the anger out. There is a lot of anger around homelessness, but I took it like it was business. It wasn't right. Personal. It was business.
Right.
If people had a place to go, like the other programs, AA and NA, if they had a place to go, I think there would be people who would want to come in and just listen to find out what's really going on.
Sure.
What is really happening and not happening out there.
So maybe you need to start one of those groups.
I've got a lot of free time on my hands right now. I would love to.
Vicki, I want to thank you for being with us. Your voice is very, very important. And I think all of us need to spend more time listening to you and to others who know the reality of the streets.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Throughout today's show, I've talked about the people who show up at the door at City Road Chapel United Methodist Church every day. People like Vicki and David and Cleo and Johanna. And almost every week I find myself at the hills of Calvary Cemetery in North Nashville, saying prayers over the graves of people like Johnny and Whitney and Susan and hundreds of others who have died alone on the streets and who would have no funeral without the love and care of those who believe that all people, regardless of their situation, are of sacred worth and are worthy of honor and respect. It's easy for us insiders engaged in providing services to get caught up in the details and politics of it all. And I admit, as one of those insiders who's asked daily for help, it's easy to get cynical about our inability to have a viable and tangible solution to their questions. There are lots of folks like me working every day to offer assistance, but it's an uphill slog, where signs of progress are slow at best. We find ourselves caught up in numbers, the number of dollars spent, the number of people housed, and all sorts of metrics that try to get a handle on the issues we face. And yet, this is ultimately about people, people just like us. There are all sorts of reasons why they are experiencing homelessness, but the fact is that just because they don't have a warm bed or a hot shower, it doesn't take away their humanity. There are people who have found themselves in a bad way, sometimes because of bad decisions, but just as often through no fault of their own. And when they come to my door seeking immediate help, more often than not, I have to tell them that the resources are limited, that it takes a long time to get assistance, and that we simply don't have enough housing to meet the needs of those on the streets. City leaders will tell you that we're making progress, but are we really? Ask yourself, do you see progress? And even if we do, it's not fast enough for the man who's sleeping on the porch of my church building. And every month, over 100 people are evicted from where they've been living in Nashville and are facing a future that seems pretty hopeless. Homelessness cannot be solved by the city, nor by nonprofit providers, nor by faith communities alone. It can only be solved when we join together and recognize the humanity of all people. It can be addressed when we work together to find solutions so that all people have the opportunity to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is not an us and them issue. This is something that every one of us must be working to end. I don't want to go to the door anymore and have to say there really isn't much hope. I'm ready for us to take seriously the call to end homelessness once and for all. I want to thank our guests again. Adam Riggi, Sally Lott, Rachel Hester, Tracy Pakovich, April Calvin, and Vicki Batcher. This Is Nashville is a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced by Judith Tackett. It was directed by Tasha A.F. Limley. Our board operator is Liv Lombardi. This series is thanks in part to support from Pinnacle Financial Partners. Music for this series is by Vane Melter. Listen back at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get good podcasts. The conversation doesn't end here. Tweet us at thisisnashville. Find us on Instagram and tell us what you want from our show by filling out our quick survey online. This is Nashville. I'm Jay Voorhees. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. I was scared.